a shot in the dark. Wary sort of spark. I'm a light that's too bright for me to see.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, here we go. Episode 287. Oh, it's Monday of Mardi Gras. Mardi Gras Monday here. Wow, we're just rolling. Tomorrow's going to be Fat Tuesday. Then we're going to be off into Lent. Woo, pump for Lent. Let's do this. I'm not pumped for Lent. I am kind of pumped for Lent. I got some plans for Lent. We'll see what happens. I usually make my plans for Lent like on the Friday after Ash Wednesday. It's like, I should probably be doing something. So, I have a plan. And as always, I start with these grand plans, but we'll see what happens. We'll talk about that later, though. So anyway, it is Mardi Gras, carnival, if you want to call it that. You know, what do they say down in New Orleans? Laissez le bon temps rouler. Let the good times roll. So that was the last couple days, just kind of get it out of your system. You know, I think I got it out of my system this weekend. But that gets us right over into the weekend recap. I need I really want some cheesy 80s like segment intro music, like a weekend, the weekend recap. You know, like that kind of that guy's like Sunday, Sunday, Sunday. I want that weekend recap. That would be amazing. oh goodness, it's Mardi Gras. So Friday, weekend recap. Friday, as I told you I was going to do, I followed through on my threat and I went forth and saw the work of the lovely and talented Ally Kavanaugh from her, I believe it was from her Immerse series, that the watercolors of the children and stuff, just so beautiful, over at a Bend gallery. And I have to say, there was a lot of really beautiful work at the Abend Gallery that night, the Sight Unseen show. And it's up. If you're around Denver, that show's up for another month. You can see three in-person live pieces of the work of the amazing Ally Kavanaugh. And there were some beautiful paintings there. I mean, there was some really interesting stuff. There was a lot of stuff, and I'm kind of like, it's kind of gimmicky, or like, I'm not so, you know, okay, yes, that's technically really good, but it, in the sense of like, that took a lot of craft to do, but, but there were a lot of really fascinating, pieces though. I think the thing I was most struck by, as I usually am when I go see, paintings in person, is, the colors, just how, I'm a big fan of like dirty, muted kind of colors. And there were some pieces there that just played with color in a way that were just, it didn't even matter what was on this canvas, just the colors themselves and the way they played together in the forms were just so beautiful. But now I don't like modern art in the sense of like, just like, this painting about painting where using color to talk about color. I'm just not interested in that. But I do think that, color is, how to say it, you know, Susan Lang, is that her name? Yeah, I think Susan K. Lang, is that her name? She wrote a book or a philosophy essay, I can't remember which one it was, and called Philosophy in Another Key. And I remember Susan K. Lang, I think that was her name. I'm messing up her name, I think, but anyway, it's been a million years since I read this. Anyway, it doesn't matter, because the general idea was that in music, different tonal shifts and different changes in notes mirror different emotional states in the human person, and they can either invoke them, or if you're already in them, sometimes it can kind of cancel them out cathartically, you know. And it's my personal theory that color colors and the relationship between colors have the same kind of ability to do that kind of thing. Because I can really feel something deeply evoked in me or accompanied in me by just color. And I'm really bad at color. I'm not a good artist when it comes to color. Most of the work I've done in my life as a visual artist, which was a very long time ago, was done in graphite and charcoal. I'm a very black and white guy when it comes to my own work. But color is deeply human and deeply effective. Affective. Yeah, there's a corollary. There's a little sidebar on color. But there was like some beautiful paintings there, really interesting stuff. And there were things that did in a different way, kind of what I think makes Ali's work so great, in the sense they showed persons and their really deep particularity. And so that was the ones that I kind of, and that's always what I gravitate to. I like interesting portraiture, mostly figure painting, figure and portraiture in the disclosure of the very particular human person in a moment. It's just fascinating. But Ali's work is twice as beautiful in person. It is so, just standing in front of this object and just seeing, you just have to go to AliKavanaugh.com and look at her Immerse series. I think that's what it's called. It's just the one where there's all the children and they kind of look like they're underwater or something, because kind of the paint where their hair is kind of rising almost, you know. It's they're so evocative, and they're so I don't understand how someone can get such absolute realism in faces and in figure. And then be doing that in a process that is clearly so kind of purposely messy, in a way to let the paint run in certain ways to get effects and everything. It's just strange. It's like two things that don't normally go together. The juxtaposition of the style and the clarity of it is just, it's stunning. It's really, really beautiful work. And I have to say that maybe I was just hanging out around her paintings a lot more than the other paintings, but I think more than any other paintings in the giant, it was a giant show. It was a lot of people stuff there. And a lot of the artists were there kind of capturing people and talking about their work. And Ali, unfortunately, couldn't be there. But people were getting caught in front of her paint. We're getting caught in front of her paintings. They were just getting transfixed and spending like 5 minutes or more at a show, which you normally is kind of like sit and look at something for a second, then kind of move on. It seems like, I mean, people were getting caught in front of her work and just taking it in. It was amazing. It was beautiful. I think just hands down, she had the best stuff in the show. And it was definitely, it seemed to me that people were responding to it in that way. But, a couple of friends, shout out to Brent Monero, who came out, Jim Ducky Laurent, the lovely and always charming Kelly Bateson. So it was a good time. I don't know who else that I invited, a bunch of people, but it was kind of last minute. So hopefully some people will swing by over the course of the show and have a look at it, even though they missed the opening. So there you go. That was Friday night. Saturday, after having a, I was meeting with a kid that I'm a, kind of, I won't call it, say, mentoring, but I'm spending some time with him, speaking into his life, kind of giving him the benefit of the doubt of like, hey, this next 20 years, the next 20 years you're about to go through are the years that I really screwed up bad. Let me tell you what not to do, kind of that thing. But then that night we had a big old Mardi Gras shindig down at the Denver Press Club, sponsored by, I think it was, I don't know if it was officially a Young Catholic Professionals thing, but certainly that was the people who came out. Nissa LaPointe and Gina and who else was on? Two or three people put this thing on, and it was spectacular. It was really, really, really beautiful. It was a good show. Good music, good dancing, beautiful Cajun food, jambalaya, gumbo, I think it was, just absolutely gorgeous stuff. And it was just packed. and everybody was dressed to the nines. And suffice to say, a good time was had by all. A little bit too much of a good time for some of us. We Ubered, you know, we Ubered. I definitely will admit that I pushed the limits of that distinction between drunkenness and hilarity. That I'm not saying I broke that line. I'm just saying that line between those isn't a straight line anymore, because I kind of pushed on it really hard a couple of times. But it was all done. It got a little out of hand, but it was like Catholic out of hand. It was like, you know, it wasn't like naughty or anything, you know. And people had a great time and hung out, and we went out afterwards. And went to Polished, which is a play on words. It's Polished. It's a Polish bar downtown. And we continued the dancing and Mardi Grawing over there, letting the good times roll. And I tell you what, I literally let the good times roll. I walked down the street to buy a pack of cigarettes for someone. On my way back, wasn't paying attention, was kind of walking kind of fast, and there was a drop off I didn't see, and I took a tumble. I mean, a really serious tumble on the concrete. And I tell you what, I'm sore. I'm really sore. To think that I slammed on concrete easily that hard or harder several times a day skateboarding for like 14 years, and whew, buddy, I tell you what, I am old and fat and in pain from falling. It's like I took a hard fall, man. It was rough. It's been a while since I just bit it. It's like, so, oh, that was not a good time. And I was perfectly sober at that point. So, as I was the entire night. All right, so you're listening to The Counter Position. Let's go to the break.
Let my sacred word to mutter. Ran too fast and turned to butter. I'm a bit too much for me to chew.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counter Position, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
Let me skip across the pond. I'm an ocean on and on. I'm a fish with no bowl that I outgrew. Lift my blood. Only one on track.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. Yeah, so before the break, I was telling you about us having a good time Mardi Gras, dancing, tons of dancing, you know, and it was, it's interesting. It's such a strange situation when you go, it's mostly like Catholic singles. You go to like this thing, there's dancing, and suddenly I am back at this junior high dance. Just like all the weird kind of like crap going through your head about asking people to dance, and girls are sitting around waiting on boys to ask them to dance, and guys are like standing off to the side talking, and the girls are frustrated because the boys aren't asking them to dance, and then the boys are like wanting to ask girls to dance, but they're like, oh, I don't know, what should I do. It's like, it's bizarre. It's like you become seventh grade all over again. So that was a strange situation. It's kind of like that at the Skylark too, because we go to the bar called the Skylark a lot, which is a rockabilly club. So it's a lot of partner dancing, you know, two-step and swing dancing and country swing and all that stuff, you know. And so you're always in this like, ah, I want to dance, but should I go ask that woman over there to dance? Yeah, it's amazing how fast men can be turned back into 17-year-old boys at a dance in junior high. It doesn't take much whatsoever. We're all about two clicks off of being a little kid in a dance. I took a tumble. So it was late at night, and you know, we had Ubered over to another bar to hang out and pick up some friends of ours that ended up over there that I wanted to make sure got home okay and everything. And we go over this bar, and this a friend of mine needed a cigarette, and I didn't have any. And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to do my random act of kindness here. And so I decided to walk about three blocks away to a 7-Eleven, buy a pack of smokes, you know. I know, shocking, people still smoke. You know what? I'll say, like G.K. Chesterton said, that in the church, the pipe, the pint, and the cross all come together. Because though they are bad for the body, they are good for the soul. And you know me, you hear me obsessing over, diet and all kinds of stuff. I think that we definitely should take care of ourselves. There's also a healthy level at which we were not overly obsessed with this corpulence that we're walking around, you know. Well, you know, we have it in its right order, so to speak, and you know, we're willing to make it suffer a little now and again for the sake of good holy pleasure. I don't know if you call smoking good holy pleasure, but I'm not a big smoker by any means. I will have a cigarette now and again if the moment strikes me in the right place. But does a woman I'm friends with needed a cigarette, and she hasn't smoked in forever, and she just wanted to have a cigarette. It was Mardi Gras, and she was out having some drinks and dancing, and she wanted to smoke. So I decided to go walk 3 blocks and get some cigarettes. So I'm coming back, and man, I just took a tumble. I'm telling you, I just out of nowhere. I think that the sidewalk kind of dropped off, and I didn't know that I didn't know it was there. So I it just completely just caught me off guard, and so I rolled in a serious way. I really seriously just took a tumble. It was brutal. It was absolutely rough, and I'm still sore. I got a big old bruise on my arm. I got scratches on my knee and stuff. I'm like, gosh, how did I get that fragile? I mean, given there's a lot more, there's a lot more of me to bear down on the concrete than there was back then. That's for sure. And also, I think like when you're skateboarding or something and doing those kind of things, you're kind of expecting the possibility of falling. I went from like walking down the sidewalk, eating a hot dog, like thinking I should have brought my coat because it was farther away than I thought and it was kind of cold. And the next thing you know, I was rolling on the concrete with no understanding of how I got there whatsoever. It was, I'm just thank God I didn't turn an ankle or trash my knee or something, because it was not a controlled fall. It was, I walked off the edge of a sidewalk and just face planted and rolled. Oh, and you know what? There were people that saw me go down and saw me laying there for a second. I just kind of laid there for a second and assessed the damage before I started moving to make sure that I didn't, you know, turn a knee or something, because I have bad knees. And I think that's, my knees were hurting a little bit. And I think that's part of what it was, is I didn't have kind of that limberness. But I tell you what, people walked right past me. I mean, they saw me fall and I'm laying on the ground. I guess they thought I was a drunk or something. But I mean, who cares if I was drunk? I wasn't drunk. But if you're walking along and you see someone fall down, help them up, right? People walked right past me. Telling you what, people these days. Anyway, what else do we want to talk about? So we had a Oscar watching party last night. My roommate Jim Ducky Laurent did, and I took part. And mostly involved all the CL kids, which is nice because a lot of those guys haven't been over to our house yet. And I've been meaning to invite them over for like 3 years and never got around to it. So Jim's a better Chileno than I am. And so he invited the crew over for an Oscar watching party, and people brought stuff to eat and we hung out. And, I'm going to talk about it. You know, everybody's talking about it today, this big fiasco. So it turns out they've done some investigation about this last award and it being misannounced and that whole thing. And it turns out that La La Land won the Electoral Academy Award, but it was actually Moonlight that won the Popular. And they have a different rule than we do in the government. So, you know, not my best picture. Now here, I have some serious thoughts on this. I have my own personal conspiracy theory about this. I'm going to give I'm going to give you a Straussian reading of, you know, somewhere between Strauss and Zizek, your my reading of what happened last night and why it happened. Now, it's funny, Donald Trump said this exact thing. He thought it, like, well, he said it was from ineptitude, basically. They were so focused on being political that they couldn't get their ducks in a row. And I don't think it was quite that. I don't think it was an accident, and I think it was planned. I think it was very purposeful, and it had a meaning behind it. I think that they were, and so here's my take on it. Now, I might be completely off. I probably am, but this is, I would not put it past, because the night had been very, very political. Lots and lots of talks about being inclusive. They, you know, after the fiasco of Oscar So White for a couple of years and all that, they really went out of their way to make sure that tons of movies with lots of minorities and from different perspectives and different were very much included. There was lots of talk about inclusion. You know, Gabriel Garcia Bernal talked about being a migrant worker because he's an actor and he migrates all over the world. I'm not a big fan of the whole refugee ban. I'm not a big fan of, I will, you know, my thoughts on immigration, that we need to fix it. But it was just so on the nose. All this criticism was so on the nose. So let's look at what happened. They bring up two old, rich, white, veteran, privileged beneficiaries of the old order, so to speak, you know, Faye Dunaway what's the guy's name? I'll think of it in a second. Oh, he was in Bullworth. He was in a bunch of, he was in Annette Bening and Bonnie and Clyde. The guy, I'll look it up on the break. I'm brain farting on everyone that's listening to the show shouting his name, I bet. I'm just gonna look it up right now. Hold on. By the time Safari opens, I will have remembered this. I bet you dollars of donuts. No, evidently not. This is quite embarrassing. Warren Beatty. Gosh, Warren Beatty. That's who it was, yeah. I could not remember Warren Beatty's name. Saved my life. Right there. You got to listen to me brain fart on the air, which is not exactly a rare occasion. But so Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway, so they're these old, rich, white, privileged beneficiaries of the old order, right? They represent, you couldn't represent Oscar So White more than anything. And they and their ilk were shown to be inept. And they gave the award to someone who didn't earn it or deserve it. And it was this homage, La La Land, this homage to the old world of Hollywood, the old time in America, back when America was great. When we want to make it great again. So they did a picture about when American Hollywood was great. They made it great again. And everyone loved it, and it got lots of awards. And then, no, that was pushed aside, and they gave it to a movie which I haven't seen. I haven't seen either of them. I've heard it's a spectacular film, and I've listened to an interview about it. But they gave it to a movie about inner city black people that are struggling with, you know, gender and sexuality, and it's an LGBTQ film. And it was. I literally think they were pushing an agenda. We're at the end of the break. Oh, goodness. More on this after the break. You're listening to The Counter Position.
Then how we crave a hanging in the dark.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
people singing, please don't stay, but please don't go.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, who evidently has brain farts and can't remember Warren Beatty's name, and then completely loses track of time and goes over the break. Oh, goodness. See, here's the thing. I just had an incredible meeting with Adam. I almost got shot by Wendelberry Beach. And we went to Mass, and then we went to Indian food. And had an incredible meeting about some things we're planning for Denver and Calix and all this stuff and some things that God seems to be aligning. But I just had Indian buffet. So I really like this Indian food at that Indian place. And I tend to eat a little much. I hadn't eaten all morning. So I had like a little something earlier, but not enough to really do much of anything. And I was starving. I was really ready to eat. So I'm not quite in the sushi coma, but I'm kind of in the Indian nap. You know, there's Indian nap, and then there's like sushi coma. I'm in the Indian nap. It's not quite sushi coma, but yeah. So you'll have to forgive me with my brain fart on Warren Beatty's name and my running half my hard stop on the last segment there. So in recap, I think that the thing with the Oscars and the Best Picture Oscar, I think it was planned. I think it was they wanted to have two old, rich, white people who are privileged and benefited from the old order of the way things were come out and be shown and confused and inept and then try to hand it off to this movie that harkens back to the golden age and wants to remake the golden age. So back when America was great and they want to make America great again, right? That return to this classic old style, right? And it was pushed aside, usurped, if you will, shown to be invalid in some way, not authentic, not in no way representing a mandate, so to speak, and then a movie that was an LGBTQ movie centered on minorities and black people in the inner city and the struggle for gender and sexuality and all that was placed in that role. I think it was a absolute commentary on I think it was a continuation of the commentary of the entire show. I think they did that on purpose. Now, I might be completely wrong, but as I think the motto of the state of Missouri, where I'm from, should be is never let the truth get in the way of a good story. So those things are all true regardless of whether they did it on purpose or not. And it just ticks me off too, because I think that I'm going to switch and get a little, political here. I'm getting increasingly sick of being given these two options, kind of this America first, love it or leave it, you know, this whole Trumpian kind of, you know, demonization of people that aren't like us and fearful kind of isolationism and all that versus this idea that just identity politics and everyone needs to be looked at through the lens of their particular category and how borders are inherently racist and ineffective and illicit in some way, and that inclusion and diversity is this inherent virtue in and of itself that has to be forced. You know, that if you have a story worth telling, then it takes place in, I don't know, a small town in England or something. And so you have this small town, England, and it's about a cop in a small town in England where is the part of England or part of some country or whatever, where everyone happens to be, maybe it's like, you know, rural Missouri or whatever. Everybody kind of happens to be a bunch of rednecks or something. And you tell this story, maybe based on a true story. And the only thing people see is, oh, it was a bunch of white people. There was no blacks in that. There was no Latinos in that. There was no Asian people represented. There were no LGBTQ. There were no trans. Everyone was heteronormative. All these people were cisgender. It's like, it's a story about people in a place, right? It's like, I'm really, really tired of this politicization of every aspect of our life. And politicization means identity politicization. That's a politicization. That's a hard word to say. The politicking of, of all aspects of our life, because there is a real struggle for equality. There is a real value in diversity. There is a real, look, this is a show on a Catholic media network. We are Catholic. The word Catholic means in its initial meaning in Catholicos in Greek is universal. It's not local. It's not just the local. It's the universal. And it's, we're in a church that has saints and heroes from all over the world, poor and rich, black, white, Asian, Latino, every possible color and type of human being represented. And so we have diversity, but we don't do this. We have diversity because we believe in the things that are universal. We are involved in the constant search for the truth, big T, beauty, big B, and good G, big G, you know, the true, the good, and the beautiful. We're in search for the real, for reality, for the thing that transcends all of our experiences of things and leaves us desiring and hungering more, and the better it gets, the more we're hungry, right? And when you get a group of people who are seeking those things and experiencing those things that are truly universal, then people will universally be drawn in, and you will have clear diversity because of that, because God shows up in to different people. He shows up and answers the longings in their heart, and in that incarnational mode, he shows up in different ways in different people. And that's legitimate diversity, not this like weird kind of like check marks and quotas and purposeful rewriting of stories and recasting of superheroes and all that. And I don't know. I think that's false diversity. The same way it's like, you know, people look at the Roman Catholic Church and they go, why can't I go to communion at your church? You say that that's God. You said God wants me. God wants communion with me. God wants to be with me. Why can't I do that with you? And we say, because that isn't, it's more than a symbol for us. It's an actual enacting of a common unity that we have, a certain level of community that we care too much about to mock and act like it already exists when it doesn't. Right. So we have, we don't just do that. We don't force that. We wait for us to have that. And I feel kind of the same way about diversity, in the sense that diversity is a good, but as a symbol, as a symptom of an underlying reality. If you write a book, or you make a film, or you write a song, or you invent a recipe or a drink or something, that all kinds of people that taps into something that is truly good and truly beautiful and truly amazing and truly fulfilling within the needs of the human person per se, then you will have very different types of people drawn to it and will love it. Look at a film like Lord of the Rings, right? Or the books, The Lord of the Rings too. But the film has been more so much more popular because it's easier to consume. But those stories, those epic stories, all the epic stories, they're things that people long for and look to. Books that have just across time hit so many different types of people. That's when you get real diversity. When we're not focusing on each other and who's in the room, but we're focusing on the real ends of why we exist and why that room exists and why we create and what we're trying to say, then you start telling stories that are so universal and doing actions that are so universal and painting things that are so universal that by their very nature, they draw different people from so many places and so many walks and so many ways that you have real organic holistic diversity. And I'm tired going back to the political aspect of this. I'm tired of being told that I have to approach the world through a lens of racial and gender and sexuality identity, or I'm a racist. And I'm also sick of the racism. I'm sick of the demonization and the castigation of people's painting with broad brushstrokes and all that from the right. I'm tired of that too. I'm just reiterating my desire for things like Catholic social doctrine to begin to take a down the middle kind of line on these things, or not even a down the middle line, just a third option that's true, that really looks at reality and is prophetic to both sides. That's a barometer that they can check themselves against because it's reality, you know. Anyway, so let's go to the break and we'll hit the final segment when we get back. You're listening to The Counterposition.
Then all the color glass, that painter's palette smash. All the colors of my soul.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a hyena laughing fool. I'm a hero without anyone to save. Love decked myself in toys. I'm a poor and kingly boy. Oh, I'm lovely, and I'm dumb.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. So, man, I didn't mean to get off on this this racial thing today, but there was things that were being said last night on the Oscars, and I'm like, part of that I kind of agree with, and yeah, I like that film looks fascinating, but not for the reason that you said it was fascinating, or here I'm someone that you probably hate because I think X, Y, and Z, and I still think that film is amazing because it speaks to me on a human level outside of your weird identity politics, you know? I'm gonna keep going on this here. I got a thought. I read an article a couple days ago about Rachel Dozell. Now I'm starting to feel sorry for this woman because I think she just has some kind of weird self-hatred or something, or she's nuts or a little nuts or something. But so if you don't remember who Rachel Dozell is, I think that's what her name was. She's the woman up in Seattle that was born like a full on little blonde white girl. Right. And over time she had more and more and more. She had kind of managed to like super tan and darken her skin and got her hair super perm, so she looked like she had an afro. And she started like moving away from where she was raised and started introducing herself as mixed race and saying that her mom was black and her dad was white, or her dad was half white or something like that, you know. And she started claiming to be a black woman, and she was able to reverse pass. I mean, she was able to, people accepted her as mixed race and enough black that she would be considered black. And she went to a black college and got, I think even had a scholarship that was for African Americans. And she had even rose to the point that where she was the leader of a local chapter of the NAACP. And it turns out that she was white, right? And so there was this huge backlash and this huge conversation. And so that was all the rage, I don't know, a year or two ago, right? When everybody was talking about the story. Well, I just wrote an article about her, and it turns out that she has lost her job, lost her book deal. She is 1 month of rent away from being, she scraped rent together for this month. She's on food stamps and welfare, and she's about to end up homeless. And she's still arguing that she started, and so basically she started the phrase, so trans black, she's trans black, or she's trans, or trans race, trans racial. And it's funny, what I want to talk about a little bit is that there's this huge backlash coming to her from the trans community, from the transsexual community, and the whole gender activist community. She's saying, look, she's saying what I jokingly said years ago when I was behind the bar of Coffee Boy in Fillmore, California, and they started saying they were going to, the California public school system first started saying they were going to be the first ones to let people use the bathroom that identified with the gender that they self-identified with, regardless of their physical body and what their birth certificate said or what kind of parts they were born with or whatever. And so I said that if, and it's so funny, it was like I anticipated so much. I was joking. I had no idea this is where it would all go. I jokingly said that if something as hardwired as gender is by perception, then something as facile and cultural kind of as race is clearly self-perception. So I decided I was black. In fact, I was a black Jewish handicapped lesbian woman named Shaniqua Goldstein. And so, and people are, but you're not handicapped. You're not even in a wheelchair. I'm like, well, that doesn't matter. Just because I haven't got the money to buy the wheelchair yet doesn't mean that I identify as being disabled. You're walking around. I know, but I'm just, you're not black. I am. I mean, I have perceived to be black and Jewish at the same time. And I was kind of doing a riff on making fun of like the reductio ad absurdum. Okay, great. If we can be a different gender, something as hardwired as chromosome and genitalia and how you're plumbed and all that stuff. I mean, if that is self-perception, then clearly something as facile as race, when we all have common ancestors, we all, whether you believe in Adam and Eve, as it says, talks about in the Bible, or you believe in mitochondrial Adam and mitochondrial Eve, we have a common ancestor. We're all from East Africa, right? So, I mean, she has a point. I mean, she is African. We all are. We all can, are, if you go far enough back, we're all in the East Rift Lake Valley around and eating shellfish and just washing up on the shore and getting big enough brains to figure out how to make tools and stuff. I mean, if you go back far enough, even if you're a strict Darwinian, that's where our species comes from, right? So the idea that this person would somehow identify with a different version of something that is so much more just based on history and culture and not actual like architecture in the way a person's built. If I'm saying that if you had to say one of these two things could be self-perception, race has a better argument for being self-perception than gender does. And the gender activists and the trans activists and stuff are freaking out on her for using the word transracial or trans, being trans black. They're like, that's our word. That you cannot do that with race. Eric, well, how, why can't, and she's, I'm actually rooting for her. She's like, well, wait a minute. If you can do that, why can't I do, people were, and then people did the same thing with the transabled thing. Those people who like are rolling around in wheelchairs and they have perfectly good working legs because they feel like they shouldn't work. Now, obviously people see those people and go, okay, they're mentally ill. But why is someone who doesn't feel like their biological sex reflects their gender, why are they not considered mentally ill? I mean, I I think still on the books, gender dysphoria is in fact still in the DSM, right? Like it's such a recent occurrence that they haven't even politically got it out of the DSM yet. I think it might have gotten taken out in this last round. I can't remember. But the point being is that this woman is being crucified by all these people that are saying that you can define yourself. You can, in fact, they're even saying some of these people, it's not like they're women and they claim to feel like they're men or vice versa. They're inventing new genders and new pronouns to match said genders. And, you know, 20, 30 different gender, they're just inventing whole genders that have no reflection in reality, in anyone's architecture, anyone's makeup. So for her to say, now this is what I identify with, and race is a good chunk of racist culture. Now I would argue, no, race is who are your mom and dad, who was their mom and dad. I mean, race is a bad word there. I mean, we're all human race. We're all the same species. We're all Homo sapiens. Though, then given, some of us that are of a more European variety evidently got a little Neanderthal in the woodpile, as they say. That's a whole nother ball. I heard an article about that this week and about how certain gene expressions may be affected by that. But that's going to be a much more complex issue to talk about, because we're going to have to talk about how does that work? When does that start? How are we not talking about polygenism, which we're not. For the record, because you can't believe in that as a Catholic, and I don't. So it just seems to me that I don't think either of them are self-perception. I think history, and I think that architecture and a human person, the design and the structure of a human person, all these things are reality that we give into, not that we create in some way, right? But if we were going to assign one of them as being possibly in any way able to be assigned by perception, it would be race, not gender. But anyway, so Rachel Dozell's got herself in trouble with the trans activists, and they say that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So wouldn't it be funny if like right wingers started donating money to like a GoFundMe page for Rachel Dozell just to tick off the trans activist? That, you know, I might be willing to start that GoFundMe page. I'm just like, I think that would just be delicious enough to get involved in possibly. But anyway, so suffice to say that, you know, what is it about? I'm quoting Chesterton a lot today. Chesterton said that when a man ceases believing in God, it's not that he'll believe in nothing. He'll believe in anything. There is an inherent need for making sense of our world and our life and our existence in light of something larger than us. Something that requires something of us, even a sacrifice, a struggle to a deeper expression of who we are, or, the people want a bigger context than just themselves, a cause, if you will, a purpose, a telos, a context, a milieu in which to live that is, that makes sense of themselves. And we see that when you don't have the true one, when you don't have reality, when you don't have God, when you don't have the things that are bigger than man, then you start making the demarcations and the syntax of the differences between us as the thing that's bigger than us, and you start worshiping that. So, man, so much I had on tap today. I don't know why I got distracted on this, but Indian food nap. Let's pull the plug, pop the cork on another episode of The Counterposition. Thanks for coming out.
I take your place in marble stone. I take your place in marble stone.